Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are, we're having a walk down the Wolverhampton Canals again. It's a really beautiful day. Height of summer today. Birds are going crazy as normal. And I've been engaging in a conversation, a bit of backwards and forwards, about the idea of morals and how they affect us and our lives and whether they exist or not. So I was just going to, let's just start off by, you know, does moral have a definition? Morals have a definition. What are they?
You don't have to pick them. It's topics. I mean, I think we're going to have to engage in some persuasive definition here. In other words, we're going to have to impose some meaning on some terms so that we can kind of run with the topic. And just unashamedly do that.
Yeah.
As a part of our anarchic freedom. Yeah. This actually, in philosophy, we call that kind of way of operating textualism.
Yeah.
And there's weak textualism and strong textualism. Whereby you just impose your terms. You know, and similarly, when you use a text, you don't get into this kind of prissy thing of being academically careful with it. You just use it. It's there to be used. It's a part of the heritage, and you use it. You know, so I'm gonna just be a bit anarchic in that fashion.
Okay.
And I'm gonna say that amorality, is a system of ideas and stories and discourses which seeks to discourage some behaviours and encourage others in a society or a community. So I'm saying straight away that morality is collective, it's shared. And now I know you can talk about a personal morality, and of course in the modern world everybody's encouraged to be an individual, you know. But nevertheless, you know, that's the kind of illusory game that powers large parts of the economy.
Yep.
But I'm just not wanting to use the term. I don't want to talk about that, mainly because most morality, historically, excuse me, historically and currently across the world, has this collective, shared aspect. In fact, I wouldn't talk about personal morality, I'd talk about personal ethics. You might say, well, what is the difference between ethics and morals? You know, what ethic? And again, I have to sort of impose something on the word. Somebody like Bernard Williams, who's a very interesting British philosopher with a concern for ethics, and he died a few years ago. Bernard Williams did draw a distinction between morality and ethics. And I think it runs along the lines that morality is what I said, you know. It's that kind of social institution of codes of conduct applied across a community and actually enforced. Usually, because a moral system gets ensconced in law, in actual law, you know, which can be enforced with punishments and rewards, of course, as well, for the other stuff. And ethics, according to Williams, I think, somebody might correct me on this because it's a long time since I looked at it, but ethics, according to Williams, is about actually the actual act of reflection on conduct. You know, it's a bit meta to morals. And philosophical ethics, so these days we talk about philosophical ethics, it is the kind of the rational study of moralities. So it's often said that in Britain, even though it's kind of pretty multicultural, that still mostly people operate with Christian morality, morality which is elaborated upon the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do the other. And it's when you get a code like that, it needs concepts like good and evil or good and bad.
It's working on the.
It always becomes kind of binary, doesn't it?
You know, the binary. Yeah.
Yeah, thou shalt.
Yeah.
And thou shalt not. It's just kind of binaries.
Yeah.
You know, there's prohibition. And there's mandatory action. Thou shalt keep the Sabbath, whatever.
Yeah.
Prohibition, thou shalt not steal.
Yeah.
You know, and you get this, the binaries arrive out of the need to modify behaviour and to curtail individual freedom in order to organise social living within societies and communities, which human beings have always found necessary to do for material reasons. It's how we survive.
I think this thing about the binary is quite important.
Yeah.
When we were talking about this before, I asked you, do you think that there was any morality which didn't work on the binary system?
Yeah.
And you said that you couldn't really think of one.
Well, actually, I can, and now I'm thinking. I would say that a caste society might very well have different moralities for the different castes. And nature outlines such a scenario on the genealogy of morals. He doesn't say when or where it is. It's a kind of a notional science fiction idea of a society, but he talks about a society in which there are masters and slaves, and the masters have one morality, which is based on the binary good and bad, and the slave morality, which is based on transcendental notions of good and evil, which are quite different. The two moralities are quite different, and their binaries are a bit different, you know.
Right. Each separate morality for each group still works on a binary, though.
Yeah. So you can imagine. And I don't think it was probably true when the Chaturvana was at its height in India, probably in the Gupta. And especially when this became kind of tight and endogamous is the word there. It means that...
It's a good word.
Yeah. It meant that you couldn't marry outside the caste. That all reproduction went on within the caste. It wasn't always like that. The earlier version of the caste system didn't have that kind of... That eugenic aspect to it. You could marry outside the caste, but the caste were kind of based on dispositions, really. You know, the disposition is the disposition to be a ruler. Is it somebody with a strong will? Is it to be a Brahmin? Is it somebody with a refined sensibility and a thirst for the spiritual?
Yeah.
You know, is it somebody who's fitted for service, whatever? You get this idea, but it did get tighter and tighter. And I'm pretty sure there would have been some overarching morality. You know, some prohibitions and permissions and encouragements that worked across the board, and then some that were particular to particular castes. So yeah, you can have that, but each morality is going to get itself locked into a binary. Because, you know, you permit and you forbid, yeah? Or you encourage and you forbid. It's a kind of binary thing straight away.
So I suppose
the stuff we want you to do and stuff we don't want you to do.
Yeah.
The stuff we'll punish you for, actions we'll punish you for, and actions we'll reward you for.
Yeah.
As a collectivity. And that's what a morality comes down to in many ways.
So when you're inspecting doing some self-inquiry here, and you feel that you're perhaps working within a moral system, perhaps without realising it, but you're just starting to become aware of it.
Yeah.
And you're examining this, I suppose maybe the first port of call, if it's going to be a binary system, is to
look there.
Yeah, to identify, well, what is it?
I kind of think the first port of call, if you're doing a self-inquiry into your own morality, your own entanglement with morality, which is bound to happen because you're born in a society.
Yeah.
You're entangled with morality. Whether you're in rebellion against it, or whether you just buy it lock, stock and barrel and are a total conformist,
Yeah. You're
entangled with it. There's no way out, except unless you're born and raised, unless you're raised by wolves in the wilderness, you know? Your first protocol, I would say, is to ask, where does this come from? Where does this impulse...
Yeah. Who's deciding what is, you know, the binary? Who's deciding what's the good or the bad, where does or the this good and the evil or whatever?
Yeah.
Where's it coming from?
Yeah. Because it's kind of handed to you in a finished form, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. Possibly a few people might have made up their own.
Yeah, a lot of moralities as well. Not all, but a lot of moralities work with guilt.
Yeah. I mean, the binary thing, there's like actions in the world which are meant to make you feel good, and actions and things or thoughts that you have that are meant to make you feel bad.
Meant to make you feel guilty.
Yeah, because bad, guilty, or feeling good, virtuous, you know, that's what they want to manipulate
there. That is simply a matter of efficiency. Rather than employing millions and millions of police to make sure everybody drives on the left, why not make sure, right in the stage of childhood, when children are the most plastic, that they'll feel terribly, terribly guilty if they were to kind of willfully drive on the right?
Yeah.
They went down the wrong lane on the M6, you know. They'd feel terribly, terribly guilty, and everyone who was driving on the correct side of the road would
giving them disapproving looks.
Well, they'd want them killed.
Yeah, probably
this is Britain,
more
remember.
A road rage scenario.
It would
really.
Be like bring.
I was being polite there.
Bring back capital punishment, you know.
Yeah.
And that illustrates the point, I think, about, you know, the. So, you know, the collective aspect of morality plugs into child rearing and education as a topic, as an area of concern. So you're kind of philosophically trying to get your head around this. Education, big subject. Guilt, big subject.
Yeah.
I mean, but that, as I said, that's a matter of efficiency, because if you had to employ... If people just, everybody just did willy-nilly anything, and except if they were in fear of punishment or in great desire of some sort of reward or praise, you need a lot more police than we actually have.
Yes, you need one for every person, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, so the masterstroke, and Nietzsche would have called the slave morality, you know, the masterstroke is to put the policeman in the child's head.
Yeah.
Freud called it superego.
Yeah.
Placement in your head. And it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
I think morality is that aspect of the grand narratives that structure social organisation and put imperatives and threats and incentives onto our conduct. Or our behaviour, or our actions in the world, and in the social world. And morality is that the aspect of the grand narrative that deals with what is good, what is evil, or what is good, what is bad.
Yeah.
Conduct.
Okay. So I mean, there's a lot of alternative to that. Then, so if we're going to decide not to be bound by the. What other people have decided is good and bad, and by, you know, this imposed morality. What else is there?
Well, I would want to, if you don't mind, just step back a little bit there and say, it's often claimed that morality is just natural, that there isn't a process of making it happen, there isn't a whole apparatus of law and a whole apparatus of customs that enforces it and keeps a particular morality in place in the society. I think if that was the case, I'm saying there may be a natural animal aspect to morality, and I actually have been slightly persuaded that there is an animal aspect to it, you know, that you put inverted commas natural.
Right.
Something right in physiology. For instance, like the love of a mother for a child.
Oh, okay.
You know, the oxytocin of childbirth, you know, as a sort of a motivator to a certain conduct, you know, which is the conduct of looking after the child in a loving way and having that nurturing orientation in life. There's something natural about that, you know, inverted commas. I don't suppose it ever goes completely unentangled from the social shit, the cultural shit. But if the whole thing was natural, I mean, Kant thought, you know, that morality was the voice of God in man. He thought it was God-given, it was the voice of God in man. Freud come along and following nature, the big critic of Kantian ethics, and says, well, actually, no, it's the result of a process. It's the result of the educative, formative process. You know, and if it was like utterly natural, inverted commas, morality would be pretty well the same everywhere. Now, there are some similarities that crop up all over the place.
Well, with the mother-child thing, I would say that would be fairly universal.
Yeah, but there's absolutely loads and loads and loads of difference. So the morality of a Spartan. You know, it's a morality that's based on character, where all the imperatives and the discouragements are designed to produce a certain type of character, or the character of a Spartan warrior. So, any tendencies towards gentleness, non-violence, caring for creatures, being unwilling to kill, is bracketed out, is in the training, is suppressed or forced out. Or we're told you can be compassionate towards this person, i.e. another Spartan, but not to this person, a Persian, you know?
Yeah.
And that is so kind of so radically different from, say, from a Jain morality, which is radically different from the morality of a headhunter in the rainforest in Borneo.
Yeah.
Where the behaviour that matters is how many heads you can collect from the neighbouring villages to decorate, to put on your mantelpiece. That's what makes you a good person, a person with a fine character. So, the point being, the difference is, historically and actually and currently, of moral systems indicates pretty unequivocally that they are arbitrary. And arbitrary.
Yeah.
They're contingent is a better word, it's a philosophical word. It's contingent, they're contingent upon.
And they serve the needs of the society at the time.
Well, sometimes they don't even serve them that well, because they're kind of a legacy and they're out of date.
Yeah, true.
But they're contingent upon the historical antecedents and the needs, the pragmatic needs of a particular society. And obviously, you know, they're like everything else, especially in the modern world, they're in flux as well. Sometimes very slowly. Some moralities idly change. Ten Commandments have been around. Well, the Hebrew Ten Commandments have been around thousands of years.
Yeah.
And some of the Dharma stuff, the Dharmic injunctions and prescriptions for behaviour, again, thousands of years old, and they're still hanging around. So, for me, if it's this contingent nature of morality which makes me think, well, I'm not bound by it.
Yeah.
I'm not bound by it. At the same time, I've never actually killed anybody, and I hope I go into my grave without ever having to kill anybody. I think I've been lucky, you know?
Well, because you came close so many times. Only kidding.
No, because Well, my relatives, you know, my my father and my maternal grandfather and all my uncles on both sides were all they were all dragged off to one war or the other.
Yeah.
My maternal grandfather was in the First World War.
Yeah.
My dad's eldest brother was in the First World War. My dad was in the Second World War. And no doubt, I don't think my dad ever pulled the trigger on anybody, but people died because he was in his Navy ship making sure the engine worked. You know. And one is very fortunate historically not to have blood on one's hands.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, I don't want that. But not because it says in the Bible, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, that's been employed. Thou shalt not kill unless given permission by the state.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, indeed.
You know. So, I feel very fortunate in that. But I don't think it comes out of morality. It comes out of a concern that others don't suffer, at least as a result of my actions. As far as that is possible, I just simply don't want it because I feel it. And I probably feel it because I've done loads and loads of meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
And loads of yoga and a lot of thinking about all this. So I don't feel like I'm bound by morality because I have some kind of, I do have some...
Well, sensitivity.
Some love in my heart for the humans.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're pretty disgusting, though, you know. I mean, our biggest danger is disgust at man. It really is because they're incredibly beautiful, but they're fucking violent motherfuckers as well.
Yeah. The tack I was taking in this discussion was saying that, so I've thought about this quite a lot before, is that I don't feel I have any morals, I have no moral code. No. I don't actually really believe in right or wrong, I certainly don't believe in good and evil, or anything like that. My actions in the world just arise from what I actually just want to do.
Yeah.
But for me personally, what I want is to live in a peaceful, harmonious world.
Yeah.
And to feel peaceful and spacious and relaxed in myself.
Yeah.
I don't want to cause suffering in chaos and arguments and nasty things around
me. I don't mind causing
me.
The odd arguments because I think arguments are good. As a philosopher,
sometimes they're useful, but you wouldn't do it just because you enjoyed it to cause pain and suffering to someone.
No, I wouldn't do it to cause pain and suffering, but
no.
I suppose people get attached to their ideas, and if you have like a bit of dialectical acumen, you're able to expose the...
I mean, it's great to enjoy a good debate, bordering on an argument. It's very stimulating and interesting.
I don't like rows.
And productive.
I like
but pointless circular rows, no, not really.
No, that's a waste, right, waste of time.
You know.
It's a shitty feeling, really, I think.
Yeah.
Unless you've got some kind of will to power, you know. I can understand, just like blokes go cage fighting or go in the boxing ring or something. They want to see if they can kind of overcome.
Yeah.
And use their will to power. And we have institutions that allow that to sort of happen, you know.
Yeah.
The boys being testosterone. Somebody wants to win somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, and this, I think you can put it. You can put it in a slightly hippie-ish and probably naive formula. I say, if you've got love in your heart, you don't need morality. You don't need the compulsions and you know, the threat of the afterlife of eternity in the fire, or eternity sitting on a cloud.
Yeah.
If you've been good, you don't need reward and punishment. You don't need internalised guilt.
Yeah.
The policeman in your head actually is a right pain.
Yeah.
Really is a pain.
Yeah.
If it's too strong, people get very depressed. If they can't do anything, they feel guilty about the slightest thing. They eat a sweet and it tastes sweet and they enjoy it, and they have guilt.
Yeah.
And it's funny, it's the most saintly, well-behaved people seem to experience the most guilt.
Yeah.
And people who can kind of slough it off, or perhaps it's never developed in them, for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, the a so-called psychopath who just has no feeling for other people.
Yeah.
And like me, sees no reason to be governed by morality.
Yeah. And it would seem to me that a spacious...
I think I'm a psychopath, by the way.
You're not. A spacious, yeah, relaxed state of being would seem to... what would naturally arise from that state of being would be love.
Yeah, it's love is the root ground of the yoga being state.
Yeah.
And that's the most I'm prepared to say about it. Because it's almost anything, it's one of those things, it's the ineffable. You try and eff the ineffable, you are incapable of speaking the truth. You know, see, who speaks does not know, he who knows does not speak. Yet Lao Tzu took the trouble to say that.
Yeah.
Which of course is a self-defeating proposition. But it's there for a reason.
Yeah.
It has another use. Its use isn't to be a proposition or a truth about the universe or about the state of things. It's actually a safety valve to prevent people turning Lao Tzu's utterances into a morality. He doesn't want them to do it. It'll fossilise it.
That's right, yeah.
He's offering the truth of movement.
I like that word, fossilise.
Through movement.
Yeah.
Truth of movement through movement, so you use it and forget it. He certainly had turned into a church, of course, which it did get turned into a church, but he did at least put some safeguards in, and that's what that statement is.
Yeah.
You know, he knew you couldn't, he said you can't eff the ineffable. Nevertheless, we have to speak.
Yeah.
Because we raise our voices. It's what you do.
Yeah. So in a way, I could almost, not that I care, but I could almost describe as the way that I live as being really quite selfish, because I do just...
Yeah, you are.
I just, thank you. I just do what I want to do. But it just so happens that for me, what I want to do is not cause suffering to other people, because...
It makes you feel
that's
bad.
That's what I just enjoy a peaceful life. I enjoy that, whereas... Yeah. Now, the trouble here is, people could interpret this by saying, oh great, yeah, they're so right. We don't need these shitty morals, let's throw them out the windows and eat babies.
Well, yeah, you have the notion that Hobbesian. Hobbes says we have the Leviathan, the state, and we have morality as an aspect of the state, imposed by the state through law.
Thank you.
Because otherwise we'd have the war of all against all. And that is the nature of the human. Man is homo lupus, what is it? How does it go there? Anyway, the translation is man is a wolf to man.
Oh yeah.
I can't remember the Latin, I don't get mixed up with the cases. Homo lupus.
That's okay.
Lupus hominis.
We can manage without the Latin.
Yeah, all right.
Oh, yeah,
manage a wolf to man, you know, and that is our intrinsic nature, and that's what will happen. I kind of don't believe it.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, Rousseau, on the other hand, who was a nasty piece of it by all accounts, but nevertheless thought, you know, man is born free, man is born good. But the need for morality comes out of the corruption of society and customs. That the natural man is inverted commas good, in other words, not destructive, not hurtful to others. I mean, maybe he was too optimistic and Hobbes was too pessimistic.
Yeah, it depends what he means by the natural man. If you're talking about the natural man, as in
that's my
the yoga being state, who's relaxed and open world, and sensitive, as we know humans can be, and have empathy, as we know humans are perfectly capable of, then. Generally, they wouldn't want to be causing lots of suffering and pain and torturing people.
Yeah. Now, I think there's a thing which I've spoken about before, I call it naturally occurring communism. And it strikes me even this kind of hyper-capitalist world wouldn't function without it. And naturally occurring communism is outside of morality. Sometimes it has to operate clandestinely against a prevailing morality. But what it's based on, it is probably based on that oxytocin moment of birth, you know, it's based on that genetic, hardwired species solidarity, particularly between parents and offspring, you know, but between people in general. And you find you find everywhere. In all kinds of societies, you find people will be kind as a default.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's hard to, you know, when you are feeling relaxed and open, it's pretty hard to look at somebody else and not see yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think I do think it's just not as a name, but as a consequence. If one becomes relaxed and open as best one can, the circle of your affinities widens naturally.
Yeah.
Morality actually often has the job of constraining that tendency. Yeah. In other words, it says, don't love everybody equally. Love your tribe and hate the rest.
Yeah.
Or love your tribe and being different to the rest.
Yeah.
Let your duty to your tribe overwhelm and override your tendencies to be a naturally occurring communist. In other words, to be a universally loving being. And that's actually the message of the Bhagavad Gita, which is a sacred book. And it's all about persuading people to suspend their compassion, or to attenuate it, or to bring it back to a smaller circle. You know, and to let it be overridden by a metaphysical theory of duty. Naturally occurring commons has got no metaphysics in it, it's all flesh. It's all fucking kitty milk and cuddles. And people smiling at each other, it's very kind of animal, you know, it's right down there in the flesh. The much denigrated flesh. But you get it in organisations, in workplaces, you know. Big organisations like the council or the university, and I worked in both of them. They only tick over because people help each other out, regardless of any hierarchical formal structure. Without the informal structures, none of this stuff works. I'm actually totally dependent on it. And I would say if you wanted to build a society without overbearing morality and with violent morality and morality that distorts people's characters by putting a whole squad of police in their head, if you want that kind of society, the political job is to be encouraging the naturally occurring communism.
Yeah.
Encouraging it, you know, growing it, tending it, giving it a chance, giving it an environment in which it can pop up, you know.
So I know we have just gone over this, but I just want to be absolutely clear that, well, I don't know about you, but me personally, I am not advising everyone who listens to this to just drop all morality and go off and do whatever the hell they want. It works for me, and by and large I feel I'm not a danger to humanity without having any morals.
That's debatable.
Some people, perhaps they are.
I am. And, I'm a danger to humanity.
Well, yes.
I've been told.
You're the most dangerous one.
I've been told. Recently I've been told, man. I am a danger to humanity.
But people think, when I start going on about this, that I am encouraging people to, as I say, you know, go off, let's eat babies and, I don't know, stab puppies in the eye because we've got no morals anymore. But that's just not really...
Let's hunt punks for sport.
Yes. I would be really surprised if that's what's going to happen. But still, I wouldn't want to be the one who was encouraging some violent person who really enjoyed torturing people to just go ahead, do it if you enjoy it, mate. That's not what I'm saying.
No, it's not about some kind of wanton.
And would it be anarchy, you know, the morals we didn't have there?
Well,
we weren't living with
if you're a Hobbesian, yes. If Hobbes was right, yes. If Rousseau was right, no.
Yeah.
If I'm right... Well, it would depend on how well we'd managed collectively to institute a culture of naturally occurring communism. You know, not top-down communism, not command economy, not Stalinism, but naturally occurring communism. It's a bit hippie. It only works if there's a lot of love.
Yeah.
But people want to love. They like to love. Love is
wonderful. Love feels good. So love why wouldn't you want it? Good. And why wouldn't you want to love? Yeah. You know.
Well, I say you do. People have it knocked out of them.
They do. Yeah.
From year dot, they have it knocked out of them. And the universality of that love is replaced by particularity.
Yeah.
With this manufactured allegiance to tribe or caste.
Yeah.
Or nation. That has to be manufactured. That is manufactured.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Naturally occurring communism isn't. It has to work in the midst of the manufactured and the conditioned and the contingent. And in some circumstances, it can be completely buried, completely paralysed.
Yeah.
You can have moralities which paralyse it. I think all moralities of the social type that I've outlined do to some extent have to try and modify it or tame it.
Yeah.
That's why they hated the hippies so much, because basically they were a bunch of harmless stoners. Very artistic and all the rest of it. Why the hell did they come down so hard on them? You know? Well, it's because of what they were saying. Actually, they, you know, this is all...
Love and Peace wasn't very popular, was it?
Love and Peace, man. Well, yeah. It was Vietnam.
Yeah.
It was Vietnam.
Yeah.
It was like billions and billions of dollars worth of bombs being dropped on...
Yeah.
On little jungle villages, day and night. Whole forest being deforested with napalm.
Yeah.
A lot of people died. A lot of conscripts died, which were people who just dragged and told you we'll go.
Yeah.
We will call you a coward if you don't. We'll put you in jail. Muhammad Ali, who just died, went to jail for that.
Yeah.
Said, I'm not fighting. Why should I go and kill brown people in a country who've done nothing to me? Yeah. Said, I'm not going. Fucking put me in jail. Go on, do it. And they did. They did, of course.
Yeah.
Mind you, he's the hero now, he's dead. Which is kind of typical as well.
Well, I'm sure he's a hero while he's alive as well.
Well, he was, but I'm saying, you know, it's now safe to canonise him. So I'm saying.
But the other way that I feel that what I've just said could be misinterpreted. Oh, just passing a barge going through a lock there, a bit noisy. Is the whole love thing.
Yeah.
Oh, bike's passing. With the whole love thing. People go completely the opposite pole, and it's all turning the other cheek no matter what, and not being, you know, because there are times when it's completely appropriate to be angry and to be aggressive and to stand up for yourself, defend yourself, defend others, and attack sometimes when absolutely necessary. Yeah. And people think that because you're doing all the love and peace thing, that you have to be just like lethargically passive, man. Yeah. You know, and just like and that's not what I'm saying either. Yeah. The love that I'm talking about is very vigorous and dynamic, and will shout if necessary.
Mm-hmm. You mean faster, harder?
Will be passionate. No. Well, yeah, I suppose that might happen occasionally too. So, being a loving person does not mean being passive. And I think this is a definite misunderstanding and confusion that people have had in the past and are still having.
Yeah.
They're either like one extreme or the other. Yeah. But you don't have to be.
Well, I think if anybody ever took like a project of nurturing the naturally occurring communism and getting a bit less carried away with the institution of policemen in children's heads, that would require quite a lot of struggle. and hard work, you know, and in a sense a kind of a fight, you know, not a destructive fight, but a fight to build and a fight to create somewhat better.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen just by magic. I don't think, you know, like the hippies, you see, I mean, they tried to chant world peace.
Yeah.
If people still doing that, I think if they chant, world peace will come. No, it won't.
Does require a it's bit actually of graft.
It's got to be built.
Yeah.
Brick by brick. And it's like you say, it's going to require passion and all. I don't expect such a project will be taken on. I think we'll meander around in the labyrinths of superego for a long time yet, probably. Unfortunately, sadly.
Well, seeing as we discussed before that in terms of social evolution, the human race is still really in its teenage state, then probably we're going to just wander around making mistakes for a few thousand years.
Raging hormones.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
The important thing that to notice here and to I'm just going to wait. I think the important thing for people to be aware of here is that there's a choice. You know, if you are working within a strong moral confines, you can choose not to. It feels like it's so deeply embedded in you that it is part of you and it is you. But yeah, it's not really. You can choose.
I think you can actually see its contingent nature, which loosens its hold on you, you know, and enables you to have a bit more of a possibility of evaluating it. No, yeah. I think somebody there was a question about, well, how do we evaluate the moralities that we find within ourselves through self-inquiry, the contingent moralities we find inside ourselves through self-inquiry. How do we evaluate them? How do there was some kind of idea that you could kind of pick what you want and throw out what you don't want? Perhaps the evaluation's a big topic. And it's one of the most crucial things to be worked out, I think. And whether anybody has really cracked it at the moment, I don't doubt, except me, of course. I have some ideas, but I don't think it's as easy or straightforward as the way the word can trip off your tongue suggests. Evaluate, let us evaluate this way.
Yeah.
You mean, evaluate means assign a value to. If you're going to assign a value to something, you need like a yardstick or a measuring stick to give it the value, to give it the number. You know. You need some comparator to do that, some means of. And that's traditionally been supplied by the grand narratives, by the book. So we measure it against the Bible. We've got a moral dilemma, we'll go and look in the Bible.
Yeah.
And that's a transcendental guarantee. Because the Bible has been given by God. Yeah. Since the Bible has been given by God, it's guaranteed and we can trust it with our evaluations. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't do that anymore.
Say that last sentence again.
I don't know about you, I can't do that anymore. It just simply seems half-baked to me that the answers would be in a book written in the Bronze Age. You know, it's a book, it's interesting, etc. But why, other than an act of fiat, why should we give it this role of transcendentally guaranteeing our evaluations? No reason. There's no reason. You can't provide a reason. Like, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Well, what guarantees the Bible? They say, oh, the Bible is just its guarantee, but why? It actually seems really improbable.
Yeah.
That the Bible could be a guarantee, especially when you read it, because it's full of shit.
Yes.
And then you get the same thing with the Vedas. The Vedas are the biggest pile of nonsense you ever read. There's magic spells to make your neighbour's cattle die. And this is a holy book. I won't mention any of the others because I don't want my head cutting off or anything.
Okay, and we'll still stop there then.
You know, so there are no transcendental guarantees.
Yeah.
Without for us to provide a touchstone for us to evaluate anything. Anything that we want to ascribe a value to. Yeah. In other words, when you're asking the question, is it better to be a pacifist or a modified pacifist or a militarist? Is it better to be?
Yeah.
That's an evaluation. Well, what you need to measure it against some notion of the good.
Yeah.
And of course, this was Plato's conundrum, is to try and find out what the good is, where to find it,
yeah,
what its nature is, etc.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of our walk now. Let's get
let's leave evaluation. There's an open question for another day, but
okay,
it'd probably keep me talking for a fortnight easily.
Yes, maybe we'll do a podcast on that next.
I don't think anybody's gonna follow what I've got to say about it, to be honest. But,
okay, well, I hope there were some interesting thoughts in there for everybody, and we'll speak to you soon.
Love is the law, friends. Love is the law.